broadly speaking, if one were to think of perspectives on conservation or why conserve nature, I think there are these two broad perspectives: nature for its own sake and nature because it's useful to human beings. But we need to also look at some of the nuances and some of the complicated history of how these ideas have come about.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast. I'm your host, Andre Mode. I think today's episode exemplifies the philosophy behind this podcast. It's about making the case for conservation robust and credible by trying to understand the reasoning behind a key conservation concept and making it transparent and understandable to others. It's also about being true to our motivations for conserving nature, as opposed to using just any argument or any means to justify our ends. If you ask someone why they want to conserve nature, it's likely that they'll say, because nature has a right to be protected, and or because nature benefits humankind, or some version of those two reasons. That second reason has been elaborated under concepts like ecosystem services, natural capital, or nature's contributions to people. It includes the way that nature regulates, for example, how microorganisms recycle organic matter and wetlands purify water, the way that nature provides, for example, food, fiber, and timber, and the spiritual value that we attach to nature, as illustrated by a love for nature and nature as a key part of culture and religion. Sharadchandra Lele, or Sharad as he's known, has written extensively about frameworks that attempt to explain our relationship with nature and our reasons for protecting it, like the ecosystem services concept. We spoke about some new angles from which he proposes we view them in a fascinating discussion that I think anyone interested in conservation will find thought-provoking. Sharad is a distinguished fellow at the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and the Environment in Bangalore. He has a PhD in Energy and Resources from UC Berkeley, and he's held a senior research position at the Pacific Institute, as well as fellowships or visiting fellowships at Harvard, Stanford, and Cambridge universities. Before launching into the theory of our discussion, I asked Sharad, who began his career in engineering, how he made the transition to conservation and related topics.
When I entered my engineering college, I was already hooked on to bird watching and wildlife as a hobby. And I was doing a little bit of mountaineering, so sort of, you know, close to nature in some sense. And my institute where I was doing my undergraduate engineering actually supported a lot of this kind of extracurricular activity. So we got to do a lot of it. We went bird watching all across the country. We went tiger watching, rhinos in Assam and so on. But I continue to think of it just as a nice hobby and, you know, sort of engineering as what I was doing. But halfway through my engineering, I encountered this book called The Citizen's Report on the State of India's Environment, 1982. And it was curated and published by a coalition of many journalists, activists, and scientists all working together. It was completely unofficial in that sense. And it was an amazing effort to pull together for the first time the environmental situation in India from multiple angles. And when I read through this, suddenly there's sort of like a bulb going off in my head, you know, which said, well, there is a chapter on wildlife, but the other chapters were covering so many other things. So there was energy, there was land, there was water, there was forests, there was habitat, cities. So there was like a whole range of things that it pointed out that environment is not just birds. Environment is not just whales or pandas. It's much more than that. And in fact, everything around you is the environment. What you breathe, what you eat, what you drink is the environment. And in that sense, environmental issues cut across your entire life. Mm-hmm. And that was like really a turning point for me. And I decided this is really what I wanted to do. Because I'd been sort of slowly getting disenchanted with engineering, sort of the standard route into the corporate sector. And I was this was really a turning moment for me. So, this is where I want to be. Conservation gave me the entry point because it got me hooked into these questions. But then when I sort of decided that that's what I wanted to do, given my engineering background, I moved more into energy studies, looking at the environmental impact of hydropower dams and then slowly made my way into forests, forest ecology, and forest economics, and later on in water and so on. So I sort of moved across the entire gamut of environmental questions. Always had some link with conservation issues, but I can say today my main focus, and so that's why I'm also in the center called Center for Environment and Development, because my main focus is looking at the interface between developmental questions and environmental questions broadly constituted, including but not limited to conservation.
I would imagine that broad gamut of subject matter that you kind of traversed across must also give you quite an interesting perspective on things, as opposed to someone who began in conservation and continued in conservation.
Yeah, I think so. I think because what happened was, because I kind of continued to think of conservation as part of what I was doing, and I at various points worked more in the conservation arena and then moved out again. So I've had the opportunity to look at the question from sort of both an insider and an outsider perspective. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, am part of an organization which is very heavily into conservation. The other center in my organization is called the Center for Biodiversity Conservation. So we work on this issue quite a bit. But it's also interesting to kind of spar with each other and push each other to look at things more broadly and so on. So it's been a really good experience for me to see the problem as a conservationist, as an environmentalist, and then as a developmentalist in some sense, sort of looking at it from all these perspectives.
Right. So our main topic for discussion is frameworks for viewing the relationship between humans and nature, and with an emphasis on our reasons for conserving nature. And just by way of introduction, I guess, for those less familiar with this topic, long ago, maybe 100 years ago, looking at the modern era, conservationists began motivating for conservation ostensibly for the sake of nature itself, nature for the sake of nature. And then many decades later, in about the 1980s, the concept of ecosystem services began to dominate the discourse. I think it actually originated a little bit earlier than that, but that's when it really kind of kicked off, and then got another boost in the early 2000s with the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And basically that approach was arguing that we should conserve because we rely on nature in various different ways. Could you go into a little more detail about how these views developed and evolved? And then at the same time, maybe also just to share your thoughts on that evolution.
I think you're absolutely right that, broadly speaking, if one were to think of perspectives on conservation or why conserve nature, I think there are these two broad perspectives: nature for its own sake and nature because it's useful to human beings. But we need to also look at some of the nuances and some of the complicated history of how these ideas have come about. Mm-hmm. And if you go back even to the 1920s or 1910s in the US, for example, the beginnings of sort of a national park kind of movement or conservation movement, it was very much about acknowledging that there are very nice spaces that people would like to enjoy. Having moved into urban areas, now they would like to go and actually enjoy those spaces and making those spaces accessible to human beings. Mm-hmm. So some of the stuff, for example, in Montana and so on, you go to a park and you'll see that it says very explicitly it was about building roads or building railway lines so that people could actually come and enjoy nature. So you've sort of othered nature to begin with. You were initially very much sort of intertwined with nature, but due to industrialization and so on, you were able to kind of pull away and go into cities. And now you feel kind of the need to go back and connect once in a while. And so that nature was more aesthetic, giving you a sort of an experience. So you could say it is still a utilitarian perspective. You're looking at nature as something that gives me pleasure, not and for which I will build roads, I'll make, you know, railway lines, I will manicure that nature a little bit so that I don't get eaten up by bears or something, you know, as part of wanting that experience. So it's a little complicated that if you look at, you know, the British sort of bird watching movement, it is very much wanting to watch birds because they give me joy. And then you see people casting it in terms of birds having intrinsic value or animals having rights. So you see sort of this slightly wavy or slightly meandering thought process, which is natural because our thinking about nature has also evolved over time. So one side of it is where we say nature for its own sake, but when we say own sake, sometimes we mean for my sake, but in a non-material sense, you know, for my aesthetic pleasure or my spiritual pleasure because nature is beautiful and so on. And the other side was, if you look at the origins of the ecosystem services idea, it originated with Gretchen Daily and Paul Ehrlich asking the question, if we were to leave the Earth and go and colonize a completely uninhabitable planet, which elements of nature, which bacteria, which fungi, maybe which plants and which animals, and we had very limited space on that spaceship that was carrying us, maybe, I don't know, you know, maybe 100,000 people to that planet. They had very limited space to carry nature with them. So what would be the elements that you would have to take with you in order to colonize an uninhabitable world and then make an ecosystem out of it, where there is photosynthesis and there is, you know, stuff growing and that you can eat and so on and so forth. So that, that was their idea, where maybe there's not even oxygen to begin with and you need an ecosystem which will produce an oxygen-rich climate. And so they sort of tried to do this thought experiment. And so the idea of ecosystem services at that point was really about what is today called indirect services or regulatory services. Looking at, for example, that if you have something that photosynthesizes and then you have something else that is eating the plant, then you will have to have something that is also processing dead matter. Because when the animal dies or when the plant dies, then you need some bacteria which break down the dead matter and make it again available to complete the cycle. So a lot of the thinking was about ecosystem functioning and regulatory services, as they are known today. It wasn't really about material benefits to human beings, although that's obviously part of it. You're carrying plants because, you know, you need to eat them. But it was this kind of focus on indirect services. Very soon, however, they kind of changed it and wrote this book on ecosystem services, which was focused on the entire range of how nature benefits human beings. And therefore, the focus shifted to the material. And I think that they would argue that, well, we haven't dropped the non-material. Nature as a cultural service is part of the three services that we're talking about: provisioning, regulatory, and cultural. So the nature as spiritual, nature as giving us an elevating experience and all that is part of ecosystem services. So they are constantly defending themselves against the argument that they have become very utilitarian in their perspective, very materialist in their perspective, nature only to the extent that's useful to human beings, by saying that, well, cultural service is all about the non-material. And the pushback that comes from people taking the ethical position that, well, you're still thinking of nature in the service of humankind. The word services gives it that feeling that it's nature in the service of humankind, which means that there are elements of nature that are not useful, not beautiful, then it's okay to sort of knock them out, right? And the biocentric guys, the deep ecology folks would argue that that's not okay because nature has a right, you know, right to exist in itself. So this is the debate and the, you can say to an extent, the schism within the conservation community that's been going on since, as you said, 2005, the Millen Ecosystem Assessment came out, emphasizing the value of nature for humankind, even in this broad sense, including cultural services. And that schism continues because there is this tension. Are we kind of shortchanging nature? Are we being unfair to nature and so on? And I think the problem is not really a big schism, if you think about it, but it comes, I think, from the fear that even this framing of ecosystem services is really driven by a slightly non-transparent strategic way of making an argument. There is an interview of Gretchen Daily in Nature, the science journal, in which she says that this idea of ecosystem services was a way of buying time and getting buy-in. This is a period when some conservationists felt that, you know, policymakers are not paying attention to the idea of nature for its own sake, or that wildlife because it's beautiful, forests because they, you know, we need to have some wilderness in our lives. This is not getting any traction in the policy space. And so we need to figure out something else. And so it seemed like they came up with this argument, an argument which perhaps they don't believe in themselves. When you say you're buying time, it means you're putting forth an argument that's you don't really believe in, but it's something, you know, throw a bone for the policymakers to get them hooked into this idea of conservation. And the question that arises, do we believe in it or not? Because if you believe that, we should go along this path of looking at all the values of nature for human beings in the material and non-material sense, then a project which provides more value at the cost of some nature will trump nature in a particular context. So a mining project, for example, might come out to be more valuable, quote-unquote, especially if you do it in monetary terms, than a than leaving the forest intact with the mineral hidden below it. And the question is, if you go down this route and say, yes, we should take decisions about nature in terms of how valuable it is to human beings, then you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Mm-hmm. And then you will have to allow for mining where the value of mining trumps the value of not mining, unmined nature. Hardcore conservationists hate that idea because they have decided that everything that is wild or semi-wild or relatively undisturbed on the face of the earth today needs to be conserved.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, any decision which might go against that is seen as not okay. Mm-hmm. So we have got this kind of schism because both sides are being, I think, slightly dishonest or not reflective enough. One side is putting forth arguments that it doesn't necessarily believe in itself. And, you know, it says, well, yes, but we don't necessarily do economic valuation. We do plural valuation or, you know, nature. The intrinsic value is also part of cultural services or something. Then it becomes a bit of a muddle. Mm-hmm. Or the other side is saying that, well, we believe that nature has to be conserved, period. And we don't need any decision making around it. Really speaking, all nature has to be conserved.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, you're not open to any decisions that would modify nature, forgetting that you are living a lifestyle which is completely modified nature. Those who are calling for conservation are all living in a non-conservation lifestyle. It's right. A heavily modified world.
That modified lifestyle that you referred to is also very beneficial, of course, to those who maybe take it for granted, right? Given the chance, they would probably keep that rather than go back to living it rough.
You actually touched on a very interesting point, which is that if you look at the ecosystem services framework and say, is this a good way of representing our relationship with nature? You know, nature provides us provisioning services like food and timber and fish and so on and so forth. It provides us with regulatory services because it regulates the climate, regulates the hydrology of rivers and so on. And of course, it has cultural value, right? Mm-hmm. But is this an accurate way of representing our relationship with nature? And two things that immediately pop up is, one, are there trade-offs? If you just say nature provides all these things, then it suggests more nature is good on all these fronts. You know, more nature means more food, more regulatory services, more cultural values, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not actually the case. For example, if you wanted to sequester carbon today, in a sense, enhance the carbon regulatory service of ecosystems today, you should just be going crazy planting trees. And you could be planting even monocultures of exotic species. You'll sequester a huge amount of carbon.
Mm.
But that's not going to be great for biodiversity. And if you want to sequester carbon, then you cannot touch that tree. That means you cannot really produce timber. You can't use it for timber, or you can't certainly use it for firewood. You might even plant agricultural land with trees, in which case you might lose food, the food part of nature. So there are trade-offs. And if you just, in a simple-minded framework which Millennium Ecosystem Assessment put out, it just seemed like more ecosystems, more ecosystem services, more human well-being. And that's too, you know, oversimplified.
Mm-hmm.
The second part, which is perhaps even more important, is that if you look at human history, you know, the last 5,000 years or more, it's been actually about either running away from nature or getting control of nature, because nature is also a pain in the neck, because it bites you, it gives you disease, it floods your house, it gives you a drought. I mean, nature is both a source of wonder, something to be revered, but the reverence is also because of fear. And, you know, this thing that is so unruly that it really makes our lives very precarious and miserable. And the last 5,000 years, you know, beginning with settled agriculture, where you essentially cut down forests and make nature much more manageable. You know, you have like 5 crops or 10 crops. Those are the species you're focusing on. You're not focusing on 200 species anymore. Mm-hmm. And you domesticate animals so that, again, the livestock becomes less unruly. You're not out hunting wild boar. You have domesticated pigs and so on and so forth. So you made nature much less unruly, or you're trying to make it much less unruly than it was.
Right.
And that continues after the Industrial Revolution, where it's really you figured out, oh, wow, now I don't even need to go and collect firewood because I have coal or I have gas, right? And I don't need to tame those bullocks because I can then just use a car. And so on and so forth. And our lives have become even less dependent on this unruly nature.
Mm-hmm.
And we are less afraid of that unruly nature. We can build dams and control floods. We can build embankments and dikes on the Dutch shore and keep out the ocean. And, you know, we've become more and more powerful in a sense, taming nature, or at least we think we have, right? Mm-hmm. But whether we have actually tamed it or not is besides the point. The wanting to tame comes from the fact that nature also provides disservices. Nature hurts us as much as nature also gives us. Maybe the hurt is less, otherwise we wouldn't survive, but there is a lot of pain. There's a lot of disease. And to paint a picture of nature as all this wonderful thing, provisioning services and regulatory services and cultural services, is to forget all the disservices, which are the motivator of this wanting to tame nature.
Mm-hmm.
And even wanting to get away from nature. I live in a house where I put netting on the windows because there's tons of mosquitoes outside. And I'd be very uncomfortable and possibly susceptible to malaria and dengue if I was not putting that netting on the windows. Now, I've clearly therefore tamed nature or kept it away from me. And if you're not honest about that, then we get a very lopsided picture about the human-nature relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, oh, more nature is good for everybody. And we forget that people have been burning the edges of forests or, doing various things in order to keep the disservices away. And the disservices are felt by the people who live next to these wild or semi-wild or relatively undisturbed ecosystems.
Right.
You and I may not face the disservices because we are living in highly controlled environments, in
right.
cities, in concrete jungles,
yeah.
where we have cars, where we have air conditioning, and so on. Is the person who lives on the seashore doing fishing for a living in a boat which is maybe not mechanized, or first person who lives in a forest and is likely to be trampled by an elephant, that's the person who's facing disservices. Even though they also obviously get benefits from these ecosystems, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if we say conserve nature, the costs, the disservices that are imposed are distributed in a lopsided manner
mm-hmm.
across the world. They're not evenly distributed. That's something that the MEA framework hides, inadvertently maybe, but it definitely hides the disservices and it hides the trade-offs, that there is nothing like one nature which is good on all fronts. There are so many ways of managing nature, and that will give you something and reduce something else.
Mm-hmm.
So this sense of trade-offs and disservices is actually very important, because that tells you why we interfere in nature, why we plant trees on agricultural lands or cut down trees in order to do settled farming and so on, because we want to enhance one at the cost of something else, even if it is based upon nature, right? Not to mention the wanting to completely run away and build a concrete house rather than a mud hut with thatch.
Mm. There are lots of important points there. And I hope that we can also get back a bit to the equity aspect that you touched on there. And a question that I have later on, I think will probably get us back onto that particular issue. But before I get there, I wanted to also talk a bit about biodiversity in particular as distinct from nature. My feeling is that biodiversity is possibly undervalued in this kind of discussion because, the more species there are, in other words, the more diverse nature is, the more opportunities nature provides humankind, especially in terms of informing and inspiring innovation, technological, medical innovation, that kind of thing. And as an example, this is actually a few years ago, so the number will have increased, but already more than 13,000 patents have been taken out on nature-based designs and materials. And well over 10,000 papers have been written on individual designs inspired by or borrowed from nature. So how do you acknowledge biodiversity in a framework that attempts to explain our relationship with nature and that motivates for its conservation?
That's actually a very interesting question, because I've been thinking about this term biodiversity for a while. And if you look at the discourse, conservation discourse, let's say in the 70s or even in the 80s, people were really talking about wildlife. If you look at the legal framework in India, for instance, in 1972, we passed a Wildlife Act. And I think that's around the same time, several countries passed similar kind of legislation, Endangered Species Act in the US and so on and so forth. The term biodiversity came a little later, and it sort of tried to, it has replaced wildlife in a sense. Conservationists say that now we are biodiversity conservationists. They don't really say we are wildlife conservationists. Mm. Or they say wildlife conservation is a subset of biodiversity conservation, because biodiversity gives this kind of all-encompassing feeling. Again, as you see, that the term biodiversity, the way you used it and the way conservationists tend to use it these days, is slightly different. So I think you are going by the literal meaning of that, which is, I think, really important, which is, different genetic structures of different species and so on and so forth. And that difference in the genetic structure being important, because different species have different capabilities and so on and so forth, right? So then we are talking about diversity. But now, diversity can be one element of, or one way of describing nature, right? For example, as we say, you take a forest and then cut it down and make it into a settled agricultural ecosystem. The new ecosystem is clearly less diverse than the forest.
Mm-hmm.
But even there, the agriculturalists might push back and say, well, that's not really true, because now we measure diversity as crop varieties, and we actually have created new crop varieties as we go along. And mm-hmm. agrobiodiversity is a new term where then, you know, you could have a lot of biodiversity in agricultural systems, but it's a different kind of diversity than the diversity you would have in a relatively undisturbed forest. So that's why also the term diversity becomes a little tricky, because you could have evergreen forests, which are incredibly diverse in terms of species, numbers, endemism, and so on and so forth, which are sort of the standard measures that conservationists use for characterizing ecosystem diversity. But what you want to conserve may be more present in other kinds of ecosystems. We had this very interesting conversation once when there was a workshop on conservation priorities for the Western Ghats of India. The Western Ghats is one of the world's mega diversity regions.
Mm.
And sort of the question of conservation of the Western Ghats has been at the top of the agenda in the Indian conservation discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And so this conservation prioritization team tried to create maps of the Western Ghats region in terms of what are the, you know, high biodiversity hotspots in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they used whatever data was available on number of species of ants, of plants, of bees, of, you know, amphibians, mammals, and so on. And lo and behold, the hotspots all emerged in the evergreen forests. And the dry deciduous and the scrub thorn forests always came second and third. But if you look at the distribution of the iconic species like tigers and elephants, they are all in the dry deciduous.
Hmm.
And the wolves are in the scrub thorn. And, you know, the deer are mostly again in the dry deciduous and the scrub thorn, not so much in the evergreen. So suddenly, when I brought up this question, suddenly the conservation biologists changed their attitude and said, we can't use the same indicator across ecosystems. Each ecosystem has to be treated separately. So we kind of now changing our tune in some sense, because in a sense, what we want to conserve is not always captured by diversity. However, the point you made, which is medicinal use of plants or animals and so on, is an important reason to conserve. And genetic diversity might capture that, especially sort of future option value, as the environmental economists have called it.
Mm.
The option value of nature might be captured by genetic diversity indicators. The risk in going along that argument is that then somebody might say, well, let's just grab the genetic material from all the species that are out there and put it into a cryogenic facility. Mm. Then we don't need those species. We can just, at our leisure, sort of analyze the genetic material and figure out whether it's useful for this or that mm-hmm. disease, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So in a sense, the diversity of the genetic material out there is only one characteristic of nature that has some value, some benefits to human beings. It's not the whole thing. And it's represented in this discussion on option value or patenting. So bioprospecting is sort of an arena.
Mm-hmm.
But if we limit ourselves to saying, well, we should conserve nature because it has future value or because its genetic material has some use to us, we are back into the very sort of, in fact, into a very subset of the instrumental value of nature
mm-hmm.
as only the genetic material. And we will miss out on so many other things. And so in that sense, it's both useful, because the term biodiversity has often been used in such elastic ways. So what has happened is basically the wildlife conservationists, those who really want to conserve megafauna, iconic megafauna like the whale or the tiger or the lion or the elephant, fly under the biodiversity umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that's good. If you conserve everything, then you'll conserve these animals also. The bioprospecting guys are also flying under the umbrella, although their goals are different. The biocentric or the deep ecology guys are embracing this because they're saying we have to conserve all of nature. But in fact, as I said, when you say, well, if I focus on the most diverse ecosystems, then I let the less diverse ecosystems drop off, then they'll say, no, it's all nature. It's not the most diverse nature. It's mm-hmm. all nature. So everybody's kind of shifting and sliding, but the hoping that for the layperson, this term biodiversity will work. And I think there are both advantages and disadvantages that we need to, within the conservation community, at least acknowledge.
Just to kind of shift a little bit back to what we were discussing earlier, you've noted in the past that there is a disconnect between indicators of human well-being on the one hand, so like poverty, for example, which have improved quite drastically over recent decades, and on the other hand, the well-being of the environment, which has declined in the same period of time. But the whole idea of ecosystem services is that our well-being is inextricably linked to the well-being of the environment. And I've always thought that the disconnect was because of a time lag effect. And this is something I've heard you talking about. You summarized a paper, and I think you mentioned that most people, you know, think what I thought, that we may still be facing the consequence of eroding nature's capacity to provide for us. You agree with that to some extent, but you have some other ideas to explain this paradox, this mismatch between human right. well-being increasing and nature's well-being going down the tubes to some extent.
Yes. So I must say that this thinking was triggered for me by a paper in Bioscience called the Environmentalist's Paradox, written by Rautsep Hearn and several of her colleagues. And it's a very interesting paper. It's asking the same question. It's saying, if you look at the data on human development indicators, broadly, everything is going up. And at the same time, if you look at most environmental indicators, including biodiversity, its stuff is going down. So we seem to be really degrading our environment, and yet our well-being is improving. If our well-being is so dependent on the environment and on nature, then how come this is going down and that is going up? Mm-hmm. And they posit several possible explanations, of which they also seem to believe that it's just a matter of a delay. We just haven't yet fallen off the cliff, but we are approaching the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to table the possibility of a different explanation, and not necessarily to completely replace the possibility of a cliff. There are actually two different angles to it. One is a small angle is that when we say development indicators are going up, we should ask for whom. And there's a whole right. bunch of people who are actually facing the consequences of degraded nature, and mostly in the form of air pollution, water pollution, displacement because of many of these industrial activities. Risks, nuclear thermal power plants, then you have face the risk of radioactivity and so on and so forth, right? And many of us are also facing things like air pollution in our cities and so on. So
you're talking about quite localized problems, basically, right?
Yes, but those problems are localized. The problems are faced by the weaker, you know, typically the weaker sections of society, the ones who don't have the voice to sort of organize and push back. And so they bear the brunt of environmental degradation. Nevertheless, you would argue that even the poorest of the poor have seen an improvement in their human development index. For example, life expectancy, infant mortality has gone down. Overall nutrition levels over the last 100 years have definitely gone up in spite of a growing population and so on. So the larger picture still remains of this paradox between rising development indicators in spite of these pockets of inequity and declining nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think beyond the idea of a time lag, I would like to point out that the paradox can be resolved if we unpack the word nature. Because when we say all these things, when we say declining nature, especially in the ecosystem services literature, and therefore in the conservationist literature also, we are thinking of what I call biotic nature or living nature, which is all the living species interacting and creating an ecosystem. That's the nature. When we say nature, that's what we mean. We don't mean a piece of rock. We don't mean just water flowing without any fish in it, in the stream. We mean the biotic part of nature. When you say nature, it's sort of greenery, animals, insects, you know, that's the image that pops up.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at human history, especially post-industrial revolution, it's not just it. So as I said, the agrarian period was of taming biotic nature to make it sort of agrobiotic in some sense. But the post-industrial revolution phase is about really exploiting abiotic nature, whether it's petroleum, whether it's coal, and much more recently nuclear energy. So sources of energy, now you're not dependent on biotic nature. You don't need firewood, period.
Mm-hmm.
Coal is originally biotic nature, but it's currently abiotic. Mm-hmm. So you're depending upon abiotic nature for energy. You're depending upon abiotic nature for transport, habitation. So you replace timber, log huts with cement structures. So you're mining limestone, you're doing various things with it in order to generate cement. For clothing, you don't need it. You have nylons and whatnot, to replace cotton. So even cotton was agrobiotic nature. It wasn't really wild nature. The only thing that perhaps still requires biotic nature is food. So if you say that food, shelter, clothing, and transport, and maybe energy to cook the food and to make the shelter warm enough or cold enough, are the five sort of basics of human well-being, then most of it has moved to the abiotic, and food remains perhaps the biotic part of our these five pillars. But even there, as we know, current agricultural production is hugely dependent on the abiotic, whether it is for tractors, whether it is for bore wells, or whether it is for the chemicals and fertilizers that are going into the production to enhance the production. So even there, we have become hugely dependent on the abiotic. And given that picture, in terms of human well-being, you see a rise because abiotic nature is sort of like a savings that was out there, and we somehow figured a way to tap it. You know, our lifestyle is really booming in that sense. And then you are A, not dependent on biotic nature. B, exploitation of the abiotic requires you to actually get rid of the biotic, right? To mine, you have to wipe out forests. To burn petroleum, then you get climate change and you submerge small islands and coastal ecosystems, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So the consequences of the exploitation of abiotic nature, both in terms of getting at the resource, for example, through mining, mm-hmm. or using the resource as in burning the fossil fuel and then driving the ecosystems haywire, are faced by biotic nature, but we don't really care because we're dependent on the abiotic. And I think unless we confront this truth, it's nice to say that some of our welfare still comes from the biotic, and that's absolutely true. But the history of the last 200, 300 years is about a declining fraction of our welfare coming from the biotic, mm-hmm. from living nature, an increasing fraction coming from the exploitation of the abiotic. And then that resolves this paradox, because what it's saying is that our ability to exploit the abiotic means that the well-being will go up and our dependence on the biotic will go down. And so you'll see a decline in living nature in many indicators and yet not see a decline in human well-being, because I'm not dependent on that living nature. So this idea of nature as a living nature providing human well-being is only half of the story, or maybe not even half of the story anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's really the non-living nature that is providing well-being at the cost of living nature. If climate change is the mother of all environmental problems today, we know that climate change is not the consequence of us degrading living nature directly through the use of living nature or by cutting down trees. That's not the primary driver of climate change. The primary driver of climate change is the exploitation of abiotic nature and burning of fossil fuels, which has these repercussions. Mm-hmm. And so if we have a framework where we're only talking about ecosystems and providing human well-being, we have missed out the gorilla in the room, the non-ecosystem part of nature. And now somebody might stretch and pull, say rocks are also ecosystems and petroleum is also part of the ecosystem, etc. I mean, then you would be sort of stretching the word completely out of shape and losing any kind of analytical traction. Right. So I would rather keep those as abiotic nature and say, let's understand the trajectory of the last 200, 300 years as mm-hmm. being different.
Okay, but then where does that leave us? You know, what should be our motivation for conserving nature, all that considered?
That is really the key question that a lot of conservationists struggle with. And what I've been able to come up with, and, you know, it's debatable, but is that we need to step away from the idea that I know how much conservation needs to happen. And if we step back a little bit, and we can say, what's the larger problem? The larger problem, as I said, for example, if climate change is a problem, it's because it threatens both human well-being and threatens living nature, that whatever living nature is left behind. And if you value it for its own sake, then climate change is threatening both, right? Water pollution is threatening both, possibly. Air pollution is threatening both. Certainly, it's threatening human well-being. Just as we have enjoyed the fruits of more and more exploitation of the abiotic, we are now facing the consequences of that exploitation also. And therefore, we need to shift our focus to saying, yes, the abiotic provides us well-being. It comes at a significant cost, and the cost is increasing, especially on the climate change front, because fossil fuels are perhaps the most beneficial and the most dangerous in that sense, right? It's a source of energy. That's what's allowed, you know, people to live in Canada, Alaska, the Greenland, and so on, in incredible populations which were never supported before. So we have seen that expansion. We've seen the expanded well-being, and now we're facing the consequences. So the environmental problem is much bigger than the biodiversity or wildlife problem. Mm-hmm. And we need to embrace that, you know, without denying that biodiversity is part of our well-being, maybe for completely non-material reasons. So we need to be open about the fact that, yes, we believe that biodiversity is important or wildlife is important for its own sake, or there are elements of living nature that are important for their own sake or because of their aesthetic and spiritual value, and not keep worrying about the traction with policymakers. We need to be honest about why we want to conserve tigers, mm-hmm. and not say, I'll use whatever arguments that I can use to convince people who are otherwise not bothered about Tiger. I have to be true to my concerns for Tiger. Mm-hmm. And when I'm doing that, then I have to reflect on, okay, so I'm living in Bangalore or in Tokyo or in New York, and I'm saying tigers and lions need to be conserved. What is it about my lifestyle which is in sync with this demand that I'm making? Or is my lifestyle actually quite out of sync with this demand? Because I need to look at the environment, not just tigers. Mm-hmm. And then I will find that, well, I'm quite out of sync with this, and I'll have to change my whole lifestyle, not just talk about conserving tigers out there, but conserving the environment in here, mm-hmm. where I live, mm-hmm. or where my footprint is the most, which is maybe the coal mines in Montana or the petroleum that's being pumped out of the wells in Saudi Arabia. That's where my footprint is. And my lifestyle is the cause of that footprint. So then I need to look at my lifestyle as much as I need to look at what's happening to the tiger. Because my lifestyle is what is causing climate change. It's not the loss of tigers that's causing climate change, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we look at the environment problem more broadly, in which we still maintain that the environment is important for both material and non-material reasons. And we need to be very upfront about the non-material and not just say the environment is a source of whatever cooling and heating and food and shelter. Mm-hmm. We have to acknowledge that the non-material is an important part of the notion of human well-being. And the spiritual is an important part of the notion of human well-being. But when I say that, I can't say that's the only human well-being that I care about, because yeah. I'm saying that on a full stomach. I'm already warm, I'm well-fed, I'm well-clothed, I have a car, and then I'm saying, now let's save the tiger. Not recognizing there's a whole bunch of people who are not well-fed, who are not well-clothed, who are not living in, even minimally comfortable houses, who are constantly at the threat of destitution. And I'm often telling them that they need to get out of the forest because the tiger needs to be saved. And so that paradox, where I preach something which is partial to the whole story, I think we need to resolve it by saying we want to save the environment, but then that means we also need to recognize human well-being as part of societal goals, mm-hmm. and say, well, I am maybe overdeveloped, but somebody else is underdeveloped. Living at a level of well-being which is simply not acceptable, because I would never want to live at that level of well-being. And right. in which case, if I need to reduce my consumption, but allow somebody else to have some level of material well-being. I think it's really important for us to embrace a larger environmentalism, which includes not just conservation, but the larger story of what's going on. And then embrace environment and the question of well-being. In the Global South, we call it development, the need for some people to have an improved material well-being. In the Global North, we should call it maldevelopment or overdevelopment. And therefore, maybe converge on the idea of well-being and say, what is the level of well-being, material and non-material, that we should aim for, which can be generalized to everybody now and in the future? So intergenerational equity and intergenerational equity, mm-hmm. around the notion of well-being, which is both material and spiritual. And so I should say that I should aim for a level of material well-being and spiritual well-being for myself that is actually feasible for everybody else and can be sustained over time. So I think the way to get out of this is to really think in broader environmental terms and bring in the question of well-being, human well-being. Anthropocentric has become a bad word in the conservation discourse. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really contradictory, because all the people who talk about biocentrism are the well-off, well-fed, well-clothed, well-sheltered people. And so how did I get well-fed and well-clothed? By messing around with nature, not by walking on tippy-toe and just eating fruit that has fallen off a tree. And so it's completely contradictory for me to argue for biocentrism as if that's the only goal. It's one thing to say we need more harmony, so our aspirations of human well-being have to be balanced. But balanced with what? We have to balance with what other humans can also aspire to, future generations can aspire to, and a space for non-humans. Mm-hmm. And so we need to, I think, to embrace this wider environmentalism as a way to address what is clearly a very complicated problem and start an open conversation on going beyond conservation in some So one thing I found useful in this conversation is to say, can we use a slightly different term? Can we say, yes, there are anthropocentric values, which are, let's say, narrowly focused on the material benefits of nature. And there are maybe other values which say nature for its own sake, or that animals have rights, or something in between, like nature is beautiful, nature has, is an elevating experience, etc. And then at the same time, acknowledge that all values are anthropogenic. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you use the word anthropogenic rather than anthropocentric and say values come out of our heads, values don't exist out there. Even the idea that nature has intrinsic value, you know, maybe, I don't know how many billion years out into the future, the sun goes supernova and living nature gets wiped out on the face of this planet. Can we say nature cares or nature has a right to exist when the sun might go supernova and wipe it out anyway? Even the sun going supernova is a natural process.
Mm-hmm.
So then where are we? As human beings, we have evolved into a certain civilization that we can articulate the notion of value and values, which is not just material value to me, but the idea that maybe there are ethical dimensions beyond that. But I recognize this is all anthropogenic. This is in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I espouse the, let's say, the spiritual value of nature or the notion of animal rights, I'm not superior to somebody who is talking about the material benefits of nature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not somehow morally superior. I am biocentric and you're anthropocentric. So you're down there and I'm up here. It's a non-starter for any conversation.
Right.
And if we say values are anthropogenic, therefore they are subjective. Therefore, we cannot have just one definition of what is to be conserved. And we will have to negotiate those definitions of what is to be conserved, what is to be used, used for whom, at whose cost, can we minimize that cost, and so on. All of these have to be negotiated. I cannot impose my values, which then adds the notion of democratic environmentalism.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we cannot have a technocratic definition of, I worked out all the formulas about, you know, climate change and the rate of exploitation of nature and tigers and so on, and this is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
There is no this answer. Science can illuminate the trade-offs. It can illuminate the disservices and the services. It can illuminate what abiotic nature is giving us. And it can illuminate all the inequities in the way which we are using and distributing the benefits of nature, both living and dead, amongst ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And at whose cost it is coming, both current and future generations. And it can illuminate. But then we will have to have an ethic which gives value to, as I said, well-being, material and non-material, to equity, to sustainability, and to the idea of a democratic process to negotiate. Even if all of us subscribe to notions of conservation, equity, and sustainability, we will still have differences in the nuances, and we will need a way to negotiate them.
Right.
And so coming on the same platform is going to be really crucial for that.
Right. So I think that probably we've covered quite a lot of this ground already, but I wanted to ask if you think that there is utility in having a generic framework to describe our relationship with nature in the first place. And if so, can current frameworks be retrofitted to include the components that you've pointed out as being lacking, or do you think that they need to be completely overhauled, or do you think that maybe it would be more useful to just abandon the idea of generic frameworks and rather, you know, think about context-specific frameworks that are built from the ground up where they are required? So, for example, in a local context, you're managing a national park, and then you build a framework, or maybe you call it a management plan rather than a framework. The whole idea of framework is fairly abstract in the first place. So what are your thoughts on that, on the actual utility of having a framework at all, or what should such a framework look like more or less?
So I think a framework is useful, and a framework is important because it gives us a broad picture of what is in there that we need to think about. A framework doesn't necessarily tell you what exactly are those relationships between those different elements and how flexible or not flexible are they, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if you look at, for example, the emergence of ecological economics in the early 1990s, and if you look at the writings of Bob Costanza then, as compared to now when he's much more sort of focused on ecosystem services, Bob Costanza and so many other ecological economists have said, we live within nature. That nature includes biotic and abiotic elements. And we depend, or we are interconnected with all those elements in complicated ways. Nature as a source, as a resource, nature as a regulator, or ecosystem processes as regulators, ecosystems as sinks where they assimilate waste that you know our activities produce. So we have complicated relationships with nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes, actually, I think what has emerged most strongly, the idea of disservice also.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this very complicated relationship with nature. And we need to keep all those elements in mind, not emphasize only the biological elements. So I think a framework which says there is the biotic and the abiotic,
mm-hmm.
and our relationships are both positive and negative. We have a love-hate relationship with nature in that sense. And there are trade-offs between services. If you plant trees, then you can't do cropping at the same time, and vice versa. But also between people. So if you use nature in certain ways, somebody benefits and somebody loses. And it's not necessarily the same person. If I set up a factory and dump pollutants in the river, the pollution goes downstream and I don't suffer the consequences. Somebody else downstream will suffer the consequences. And so nature connects people across space as much as it also connects all of us with future generations. If we have wiped out resources today, we won't have anything for them tomorrow. So that's the connection over time, but there's also connections across space, which means there is a lot of questions of environmental injustice. And so I think if we look at both the important descriptor elements, which is the biotic and the abiotic and the existence of both services and disservices and trade-offs, one hurting the other and so on, and look at the other side of the story, which is what is human well-being? It's not this simple homogeneous box. It's well-being of different people across the world. So it's everybody's well-being. So the distribution side is important. The temporal side is important, that we should also, you know, leave enough for future generations. The content of well-being is equally important. Not just the material, but also the spiritual, the you know, the closeness to living nature, let us say, and so on, is also something to recognize. But a framework will not try to pin it down. So somebody might say, well, my notion of living nature is a pet dog. I cannot force that person to change that. I may argue that there's more to living nature than pet dogs, etc. But the person has to be convinced of that themselves. It can't be scientifically shown that pet dogs are not living nature and only tigers in the wild are living nature, right? Or that only tigers have spiritual value and pet dogs don't have spiritual value. You know, you can't scientifically show that because it's a very subjective experience. And so we need to leave space for all these things. But say that what are the things that we value? In trying to save my pet dog, am I actually shooting some people? Then I think we have a ethical problem. Or if, you know, try to conserve my tiger, I'm displacing indigenous communities living in the forest. And that can happen when on the right-hand side, the notion of human well-being can be expanded to accept some of these basic principles. A society which is which has material and spiritual well-being today and tomorrow and for everybody. Accept these broad principles and leave space for debates about the specifics, then I think we can move forward.
I'd like to say a special thanks to Sharad for that conversation, because it was actually the second time that we attempted it. The first time we had a great chat, but I realized later on that the record button hadn't worked for some other reason, or rather the record button operator hadn't done his job properly. Next time, I'm going to be talking to Jennifer Day. Jenny is an emeritus professor of zoology and freshwater zoology in particular, from the University of Cape Town, and she's also my aunt. She's been a big influence on my career and my interest in conservation. And she's one of those people that I've always wanted to find an excuse to bring onto the podcast because of the way she sees things and the sincerity with which she approaches her work. So we'll be discussing water, and in particular the trade-offs between biodiversity and the human need for water, especially in water-scarce places like Cape Town, the west coast of the US, and parts of Australia. So it should be a fascinating and very practically oriented discussion. I hope you can join us.